Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Christian has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore.
To go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast at thepodiumgame.com. I'm Jason Mann, and with me always is Rich Kraich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a few weeks, but I'm ready to get back on this. It's a good episode, too. This one's going to be cool. I like this one.
You're always excited about every episode.
I am. I really am. I mean, there's going to be one. There'll be one, and you can tell. I won't say that I'm excited. I'll be like, all right,
we got to talk about it. Like, going to do this one, you know.
Right. You'll know. People will know. But this one I am generally excited about. Yeah. Like, they'll know. There's going to be a one.
There's going to be one. I make you talk about the mid-2000s talks too much, and you're just going
to. Right, yeah, or like. Let's talk about the cultural impact of the 70s Knicks. And I'm going to be like, you'll know.
Not going to be yours, no. All right. Well, fair enough. Our topic today is we're going to talk about trades. Trades of all kinds, although we're really definitely going to focus on mid-season trades and really trades that sort of were at least intended to benefit both sides. So that's going to be kind of a discussion that you and I have later. But first of all, we have a very special guest. He runs the NBA Trades Tumblr blog and has a podcast of the same name, Rafael Canton. Rafael, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk about some good old-fashioned trades.
So what made you decide to run a podcast and a Twitter account and a blog that specialize in trades? What made you pick that subject?
It's a mix of things. As a kid, I used to collect basketball cards. I was a little crazy, a little obsessed with that when I was like in elementary school and middle school. And I always used to memorize all stats when a player got traded from whatever team to whatever. And so in college, I was like, you know, it'd be really cool to look back on these trades that when I was a kid, I didn't really understand why this guy got moved, you know, to wherever. Like, especially as a kid, I remember Damon Stoudemire getting traded from Toronto to Portland. And I didn't really understand why he got moved. And then when I was in college, I randomly looked it up and I found all this information about it that I never would have understood why he got traded. And so I was like, maybe I should look through every trade possible that that I looked at when I was a kid. And so I started looking through all these 90s trades, all these 2000s trades, and it brought back memories from some things. And so it sort of led me to doing that. And then I asked advice from some people, and a lot of people thought it was a cool idea. So I was like, why not get it started? And I started it, I think, I want to say 2 years ago. I started it two years ago, like 2012. And it's just like grown into something where I'm doing a podcast on the side with it, you know, and just trying to add a little bit more depth to a lot of these stories that I feel like we know about the trades, like what transactions happen. But there's a lot more details in terms of why this player got traded, how they fell, especially reading through a lot of the quotes. That's like the most revealing stuff that I find when I look through it. So I sort of like what inspired me to do it. And it's sort of weird. It's like I've gone through so many trades. It's like my goal initially was like I'm going to try and do every trade ever. But it's like with all these trades happening right now, it's like impossible. So it's hard to keep up with, but it's definitely something fun to look back at, and it definitely reminds me of those good old times when I was collecting basketball cards.
What's your favorite trade that you've ever written about or covered or done a podcast about? What's one that kind of stands out for any reason? I mean, there could be a multitude of reasons why, but is there one that kind of stands out in your mind?
There are a few. I'd have to say the first one I ever did was the Anthony Mason Larry Johnson trade. I did the Hornets and the Knicks, and I actually ended up doing that was the first podcast I did. I've only done like a few podcasts, but I did one with my brother who's also a Knicks fan, and we talked about it because he's older than me, and so he knows a little bit more about like the Knicks from the '90s, and I learned a lot about it just talking to him about it, but from writing about it, I learned a lot about it because for me as a kid, seeing Larry Johnson on the Knicks and not understanding how he ended up, you know, being on Charlotte and then ended up being on the Knicks, doing research on it made me realize all the stuff I had never heard of before in terms of his relationship with Hornets management and how they didn't want to pay him anymore. And they were pretty much reshaping the franchise after Alonzo Mourning pretty much demanded to be traded through like refusing to agree on re-signing with them. So it's definitely stuff that I never looked at before, but that's one that stands out to me. Another one that I did early on was Derek McKee for Detlef Schrempf. And that's like my ultimate favorite trade because I feel like both teams got something useful that helped them along the way and really shaped their franchises for a good 5 or 6 year stretch after, even though those guys aren't like the two highlights of those teams where we look at more so Gary Payton and Sean Kemp in Seattle or Reggie Miller in Indiana. I like those trades because those are foundational building trades that matter. Another one, I'll go for a third one. Another one I like doing, one I really like doing was David Thompson, because that really got me to look into his career, which I had never really looked into. And so that's sort of one reason why I do like to do older trades, like especially in the 70s and the 80s, because, I mean, that's before my time. So I never was, I'm born in 1990, so I never watched basketball in the 80s or the 70s, really. A lot of that stuff is from my dad I hear about, and it's really only Knicks. He's a New York Knicks fan, so I've never really learned anything about it. So that was one that really intrigued me because I got to learn David Thompson's story and what led to his career descending from his success in the ABA with Denver and in the NBA, and then his eventual downfall that led him to be traded to Seattle and then him being forced to retire. So yeah, those are probably three trades that I look at that I'm like, wow, those are ones that I really enjoyed and took forever to like write about, but they were all really fun.
Yeah. You do a really excellent job, I think, of just pulling from a lot of different sources and just, yeah, so much context and so much research. I mean, it's definitely been useful for us looking up stuff for the for our podcast. So we really, you know, appreciate the great work that you're doing there. The NBA historian crowd seems kind of small, but, you know, there's some really good stuff going on, and you're definitely part of it. So we appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it is really small. There are people out there, though. On Twitter, it's really weird. There is, like, this crowd of people who really love talking about some of the old trades, I think, because there are so many memories that are attached to them.
Yeah, and I mean, I think just the thing about a trade is there's always, like, that feeling of just, you know, with any trade, there's just a sense of like optimism, at least any trade where both sides are getting something that you feel like, okay, this could be part of our future, or this could give us just another little push to have a better chance at a championship. But there's always that feeling. It's just almost any trade, there's just that sense of excitement, I guess, that, you know, the possibilities that could come even from, you know, relatively minor.
Yeah, something's different. I mean, you've been watching a team or you've been watching somebody and now something's different. Like even if you're dumping guys, even if you're bringing guys in, you're just seeing something different. There's like a change. And people always, I always attribute it. The reason I'm a big trades guy is it's, you can kind of remember memories pre and post. I mean, it's a good like kind of line of demarcation, but for some teams or whatever, because like especially if it's a team you follow, you sort of always remember kind of what they were like before and then what they were like after. And you know, there's, you can always look at that, oh, when we traded X is when we really got, you know, this, or we really got bad, or we really got good. Or there's always kind of a fun aspect to that for me. I've always been that way too, and I got a lot of it from basketball cards as well, just looking on the back and going, whoa, he went from Seattle to Denver, like how did that happen, like, you know, as a kid, like not understanding how trades worked. And I remember I would always go go to my dad and be like, well, why'd they do that? And he would always be like, oh, I don't know. And like not knowing, hey, there's finances or whatever. Like he didn't want to tell me, hey, the salary cap. And I was always like, that guy's no good. Like, what the hell? Like, I don't understand. But no, it's now that you know it, you get a little more of appreciation now that you're older. But
absolutely. Yeah. So what are some of your favorite trades that like really benefited both sides? I mean, you mentioned the Schreff McKee trade. Are there any others that kind of stand out as like, oh yeah, this definitely worked out really well for both teams?
Yeah. There are a few. There are some really good ones. I mean, like, wow, it's really hard because I'm like trying to go through everything.
Sure.
And a good one, I'd say, is, you know, what's a really good one? The Sean Marion, Steve Nash, Dallas and Phoenix. I know it sounds crazy thinking that, but when Phoenix traded Steve Nash, who at the time was a bench player in his first few years, and they traded him to Dallas, like a lot of people will look at that as a steal. But in the trade, they got a draft pick and they got Sean Marion, or they used that draft pick on Sean Marion. So I think in retrospect, that looks a lot more fair than when you think probably the first two or three years, you probably say, oh, Nash, because of how well he played in Dallas after the first few years. When I think the first 2 years, he didn't play that well in Dallas, but became an all-star. And I think that one's, Nash ended up coming back to Phoenix, but it's that one I think is a really interesting trade just because, you know, like this, it doesn't seem like a big trade because at the time Nash was a bench player and then eventually he became something, and then you're just trading a draft pick and you don't know where it's going to end up. An underrated one I'd have to say, and it's unfortunate, I wouldn't say it's even. Now I'm thinking about it. I'm like, I was going to say Grant Hill for Ben Wallace. I think for name-wise, I'd say it's even. But with Grant Hill's injuries, it's definitely not even. I don't know. This is the head scratch. This is hard.
There's so many trades.
And I saw some even ones. But for the most part, It's hard to find those even trades. A lot of times there is usually a fleecing, or I think also players don't fit necessarily with whatever team they're joining, and so you think that based on name recognition level that it'd be even, but then it doesn't work out. Like a good example is one I did was Dan Marley for John Hot Rod Williams. I did that. I worked on that piece for a while. And it was interesting because Dan Marley had such a great career in Phoenix. And as soon as he got traded to Cleveland, he really, really struggled that the 1 year he played in Cleveland because they played a much slower system. Mike Fratello historically always had low scoring teams in Cleveland. And he really struggled. And John Hot Rod Williams struggled too. So that one's sort of even in they both were really bad after the trade, after being really good players for their team. So that one's an even one thinking about it. but that's one that actually I'd say there are ones that actually, you know, it's a good one. Seattle, Milwaukee, and Cleveland. That's a fair trade because everybody suffered from that one. The Vin Baker, Sean Kemp. Terrell Brandon, Tyrone Hill, three-way trade. Obviously, Vin Baker and Sean Kemp didn't work out, and Terrell Brandon only was with Milwaukee for 1 year. And I think the same thing with Tyrone Hill. I think he was only in Milwaukee for a year and a half. I think that one worked out perfectly from the ultimate chaos and disaster. So that's one that I'd say is definitely even from another perspective compared to, you know, looking at the Schreff and McKee trade. That one is like even from both players helped those teams succeed, whereas the other one with Seattle, Milwaukee, and Cleveland is just a hot mess.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, are there any trades that you kind of think that like are historically maybe seen as significantly better or worse than they really ended up being?
Um, I think so. Well, I think things change all the time. I mean, like, we could think about trades like currently or in the past 5 years. Like, one that has changed and I think is a volatile trade in the sense that people's opinions of it change all the time is probably, I'd say, Carmelo with the Knicks and the Nuggets, because there are so many variables that have played into it. I mean, Carmelo has gone from struggling in New York, you know, putting out 40-win teams that aren't that good, and then having that 2012-13 season where the Knicks won 54 games, and you're thinking, okay, the Knicks are building something, and then these past 2 years have been a nightmare for any Knicks fan or just the Knicks in general. And then in terms of Denver, it's like the same thing too. Denver was sort of a lower-seeded Western Conference team after they traded Carmelo, and you're thinking, okay, they got a good return for him. And then they peak with the 50 – I think they won 56 games or 57 games. I don't remember. But they won 2 years ago when they had Andre Iguodala, and you're thinking, okay, so this is working out for them. Gallinari's playing a significant role. And – that one, I think, has changed so much over time because Carmelo's tenure in New York has sort of become clouded with everything from the recent losing and obviously the news of him having the knee surgery and everything. And the Nuggets situation has sort of unfolded in a negative way with Gallinari having his knee problems and Wilson Chandler not necessarily growing into what the Nuggets wanted him to be and sort of becoming more of a trade chip than anything. And, I mean, things change all the time. Like, Mozgov was sort of a throw-in into the trade, and the Nuggets were able to profit very well off of trading him because they got two first-round draft picks for him. So it varies. That one is something that I'd say, like, a trade can change so much over time. And the way we look at it, another one I'd say also is Pau Gasol and Marc Gasol. It'd be easy 4 or 5 years ago to just say the Lakers fleeced Memphis with the two championships and Pau Gasol playing such an important role as the second best player on those two championship teams. And Marc Gasol obviously starting off well in Memphis, but, I mean, he wasn't a superstar when he first came into the league. And now we see him differently over the past 4 or 5 years. He's become Defensive Player of the Year, one of the best passing big men, one of the better scoring big men, one of the most complete center in the NBA right now. And he's made Memphis something that the Grizzly franchise has never been, which is a perennial playoff contender and a title contender this year. So I'd have to say that one has changed a lot too, because that one really has changed the way we look at trading a superstar. Because at that time, Powell wanted to be dealt. It's sort of like what we're seeing with Goran Dragic right now. But Powell was like, when I'm a free agent, I'm just going to leave. And so Memphis was sort of forced to trade him. And I mean, when they traded him, I remember everyone was pretty much, I think Greg Popovich had comments about it, and everyone was saying that the league shouldn't have allowed that to happen, which is foreshadowing to the whole Chris Paul situation. But it's amazing to see how much that has changed. I don't think people view that trade as the Lakers fleecing Memphis right now, with how impactful Marc Gasol has been on Memphis's overall franchise. Like, he's impactful in their history because, I mean, they've made the playoffs every year for the past, like, say 5 years. So it's going to be the fifth year this year. So they made the playoffs, I think, 3 times before he came there. And now they've made the playoffs 5 times in a row. So I think that's another one.
Yeah, he certainly made them a healthy franchise after a while of them really not being, even with Paul or whatever. So question that we had from a few people, and one that, you know, Jason and I always talk about, and one of our goals in doing this podcast, and I think a big reason why you do your blog and do your podcast, is in your mind, are there any important trades that have just been forgotten by history that we just don't talk about enough, or you don't read enough about, or don't get the due that they're really worth of you know, ones that were significant, were a big deal, guys benefited, but maybe we just don't talk about it. Maybe we forget about it, or it's just not as historically significant for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think some are like a lot of the draft trades are something that we forget a lot because of the players not there yet. But having the opportunity to draft a player because you made a previous trade is really important. I mean, like, one thing that I always thought was interesting was Goran Dragic. And I know it sounds so weird now that he's talking about the trade, but when Phoenix wanted him, San Antonio drafted him, but Phoenix bought the rights of the pick from San Antonio. So it ended up being a trade, and they ended up drafting the rights to Dragic in that trade with San Antonio. And obviously he left and went to Houston and came back, and he's been such an important player. That's one that I look back at that's like, wow, like, it's a underrated steal. I think they traded Malik Hairston. They traded the rights to Malik Hairston, who's not even in the NBA now. But on a bigger scale, a trade that people don't talk a lot about, I'd say the Knicks. Well, actually, no. Knicks fans talk a lot about Patrick Ewing getting traded. I feel like in the grander scheme of things, people don't really talk about it because he wasn't that great of a player at the time. By that stage in his career, he was pretty much in his last 2 years in the NBA. I feel like that one's one that doesn't get talked a lot about because it really ruined the Knicks, or it started a pattern for New York that that they still haven't been able to get out of in terms of acquiring certain players and making bad decisions on top of bad decisions that just sort of they can never get themselves out of. Even when they've had chances to rebuild, they pretty much haven't chosen. They've chosen the other path, which is a quick fix, and that's never helped them. So I think that that's a good long-term one. Is there anything else? Oh, you know what, another underrated one I'd say is Mark Jackson with the Pacers in Denver. The Pacers got rid of Mark Jackson in 1996 after they played in the first round against Atlanta in the 1996 playoffs. They were 52-30, but Reggie Miller had a fractured eye socket and he missed, like, it was like late in the season, so he ended up missing like the last three or four games. And he missed the beginning of the playoffs. He missed the first four games of the series. It was tied 2-2. He came back for game five at home in Indiana. And they lost game five at home. And then they lost in the first round. So it was definitely a disappointment for them. And I guess they felt they needed to make a move. And they traded Mark Jackson to Denver for Jalen Rose. And among other things. I think they got a draft pick too in the trade. And I think they used it on Eric Dampier. And the Pacers struggled. I mean, they didn't really have a point guard that could fill Mark Jackson's shoes that next year. And they had injuries, I think, the next year, too, like among that, too. They had, I think, Rick Smith missed a lot of time and Derek McKee missed a lot of time. And Travis Best was starting, but he wasn't really ready to take over that starting role as point guard. And I think they did a deadline deal with Denver and they got Mark Jackson back. They traded, like, it was what they gave to Denver. It was really weird. They got, I think they gave Vincent Askew and Eddie Johnson. It was like, and 2 second rounders. They didn't really have to give up that much compared to what they got getting Jalen Rose from Mark Jackson. So I think that that's one that nobody really looks back, because the Pacers had all these years pretty much except for the 96-97 season where they made the playoffs. And that 1 year they traded Mark Jackson, they really struggled that year. I think they finished 39-43. And it's such a random trade a player and then half a season later you trade back for him. And it's just so, it's such a bizarro deal. It's something that I always would want to talk to Donnie Walsh about that, because I'm like, what compelled you to trade for him and then trade back for him as your solution? Even though it did work out, he helped them I think 97 through 2000 they were a contender for a title those 3 years. And so I think that that one's one that no one really talks about. And I've never heard Mark Jackson reference being traded twice in a 6 month span.
Yeah, that reminds me of the Sean Elliott to Pistons trade. And
that's another good one. Yeah.
Yeah, where they got a lot. The Spurs were able to get a lot for him, and then he struggled in Detroit, and then Detroit, you know, gave him back for almost nothing. So it's funny how that works out. So we had one Chuck Schatz from Twitter wanted to ask us to talk about the a couple of significant mid-season trades in the 2000s. Of course, the Rasheed Wallace 2004 carousel, going from the Blazers, playing one game for the Hawks, and then going to the Pistons, and Dikembe from the Hawks to Philadelphia in 2001, which both were trades involving the Hawks that led to teams making the finals and, in the Pistons case, winning championships.
Yeah, those two trades are definitely significant. I think what also stands out is how weak the East was at that time. I mean, the East is pretty much still weak right now, but besides the top five teams, but how top heavy the East was at those times, that making those trades was so significant towards vaulting you into a position to compete for a title without much competition. Because thinking back to the Mutombo trade for Theo Ratliff and other people, I think Tony Kukoc and Nazi Muhammad went to Atlanta. It's interesting because Mutombo really helped them. I mean, obviously Ratliff was hurt and they needed someone to fill in, you know, because he was playing well. I think he made the All-Star team but couldn't play because he was injured. But Mutombo really helped them. He did everything he was supposed to do. I did his trade for Philadelphia to New Jersey, so I got to look through some of his Philadelphia numbers, especially during the finals run. And he played really well. He was a force. He rebounded, he blocked shots. Obviously, he was never like a great low post scorer, but he did his job. And he really helped them that year. I think it's just after that, he started to show signs of decline. And I think that's why they felt the need to trade him after the second year when they struggled, because Iverson was hurt a lot the year after their finals run. But that's definitely an impactful trade just because, Mutombo's, we see he just got nominated to Hall of Fame. He's definitely one of the best defensive centers. And Atlanta's side, I always think of just Theo Ratliff never really ever got healthy. He was like that guy. And he became Theo Ratliff's expiring contract. I remember Bill Simmons always used to reference that. and that's one of the things that it worked out for Philly at that time. And they needed somebody. And he was an experienced vet. So it definitely was something that worked out. And thinking about that, I mean, Philadelphia did not really have that much competition in the East at that time. I think the 2000-2001 season was really Philadelphia, Milwaukee. I mean, Toronto was sort of a surprise coming out of the East. And New York, too, was sort of decent. I think they won 48 games. The East was really Philadelphia's for the taking. I mean, Milwaukee was really the serious threat, and they didn't have a low post presence. So it sort of allowed Mutombo to dominate. The second trade, that obviously the Rasheed, is a big one. And I always think about it because of how Detroit and Indiana really were the two powers of the East that year. And there weren't really many other teams in the East that were, I would say, great. Indiana, I think, had the best record in the league that year. They won 61 games, and New Jersey was decent. I think they won their division, and Detroit was right behind the Pacers, or not right behind, but they won like 52-53 games. The Rasheed Wallace trade definitely changed a lot with Detroit. I mean, it's like one of the biggest deals ever, and I mean, it always leads to that classic thing about Rasheed playing one game in Atlanta. I actually remember watching that one game because it was local TV, and they played the Nets, and I remember watching him play jack up shots with Steven Jackson and Jason Terry on the team too. But
what could have been?
Yeah, I know. That was great. That Hawks team was so weird in 04. I remember they traded for Bob Sur. Well, they got Bob Sur in the trade with Detroit. And I remember he tried to do the Ricky Davis. He threw the ball up to the rim and tried to force a triple-double because he had two triple-doubles in a row. And I think he tried to get a third triple-double in a row. And he threw a rebound. Like, he threw the shot, threw the ball at the rim and tried to get a rebound out of it at the opposite rim. And I think the league took it away. I know this is a random NBA fact. So.
I do remember that. I believe they did take it away, but I cannot confirm that.
Yeah.
For sure. I remember the highlights.
Yeah. So the Rasheed Wallace trade for Detroit, I mean, it just made them so much more deeper. I mean, you have Mehmet Okor off the bench, and he became an all-star, and you have all these guys. Corliss Williamson has won Sixth Man of the Year. It's just a great collection of talent. And, I mean, Rasheed really was the deciding factor in Detroit beating Indiana. Just from, I mean, Rip Hamilton played great in the series, I think, in the 04 conference finals, but Rasheed was really just that low post presence. He brought that swagger. You know, I think he guaranteed a win in game two after they lost game one to Indiana, and they won game two on the road at the Tayshaun Prince shot block of Reggie Miller. And I don't know. I think the rest of it is just, I mean, the rest is history. He really secured that championship for them and made them such a great low post presence. That's what I definitely say. Is there anything else? I mean, from a long-term perspective, I definitely say Rasheed matters a lot to Detroit's success. Obviously winning all those Eastern Conference Finals or making the Eastern Conference Finals. He's definitely a significant trade, especially because of how much of a long-term impact he had on Detroit's success for all of those years, including that first title that they won with that group.
Yeah. You know, funny thing, there were two picks involved in that draft that Detroit traded. One of them ended up being Josh Smith, and then the other one was Tony Allen.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. That's interesting.
I really wish Basketball Reference didn't add that where they tell you like what the picks ended up being, because now that's just a wormhole that I just never get out of, because it's like the greatest thing ever. Like when people are like, here, take our 2007 first round pick, whatever, like in 1999. It's like, it's just guys that like shouldn't be on the same trade. You know, like you get these silly, silly ones, or, you know, the famous one is the Kyrie Irving, you know, for Baron Davis one or whatever. But I just love that they added those. Like there's so many weird ones, so many weird things that can happen, especially with the Euro guys where like Nikola Mirotic or whatever is just in like 10 trades before he eventually finds his way to the Bulls. So you just, like, any page you go to in the 2000s that involves Houston or San Antonio or the Bulls or Phoenix, like, he's there. His pick is just being bounced around, and I just love that. That's one of my favorite things that they've added in Basketball Reference, and favorite things about trades these days is just the picks and what they end up becoming. It's just, I love it.
Yeah, and it's definitely, it's hard, sometimes it's hard for me to figure it out, and, like, some are, like, this guy got traded from Detroit to Cleveland, and then Cleveland gave the pick back because they agreed to a separate trade or whatever. Like, that happens a lot. Like, trades from the 90s. I remember I did a Reggie Theus from Orlando to New Jersey. And I remember seeing something where, like, when I was doing research on it, I think Orlando agreed in the trade that they wouldn't take somebody so that New Jersey would be able to draft, or I think it was for Dennis Scott, so that Orlando would be able to draft Dennis Scott because they really wanted him in the draft. But a lot of these trades had these weird contingencies, and then it ends up involving the draft pick, so it can always be so confusing.
All right, well, Rafael, do you want to let everybody know where they can find you on the internet?
Yeah, sure. NBAtrades.tumblr.com. Definitely working on some good stuff. I'm actually working on Rick Pitino trades with the Celtics.
Oh, nice.
Oh, no.
Nice.
I know. That's why
those will be long. Yeah. Those will be long posts.
After doing the Isaiah Thomas one, I definitely wanted to get back into doing some specifically focused on certain GMs or coaches or certain eras of teams. But yeah, nbatrades.tumblr.com. You can check out the podcast. I haven't done one in a while. I've been meaning to do one, but time constraints. Is there anything else? Follow NBA Trades, NBA underscore trades on Twitter. I talk about what I'll just randomly start talking about a trade that happened or something I'm researching, or look back at some old YouTube clips of full games because I randomly watch old games usually during the off season. The off season is when I do that more. During the season, it's harder to be like, I want to watch a 90s game when there's so many available good basketball games on this year. Follow NBA Trades, NBA underscore trades on Twitter. There's nothing else. Whenever I have anything, definitely share it, post it on Twitter, and I'll share it with the people who love archives and love the old NBA stories.
Excellent, man. Well, thank you so much for joining us to talk about that. And Rich and I will be back in a few moments with more about midseason trades.
Waiting in places, want a piece of the pie. Good guy, bad guy, we each gotta die. It's all a game. Some will make the Hall of Fame while others are dying vain, trying to front for a name. Waiting in places, want a piece of the pie. Good guy, bad guy, we each gotta die. It's all a game. Some will make the Hall of Fame while others are dying vain, trying to front for a name. Dreams fulfilled, gave us more room to build.
All right. And we are back, and we are talking. Each of us picked three trades that we think are, you know, particularly compelling, particularly interesting. Kind of looking at trades that at least were intended to benefit both sides, and for the most part, the bigger the better. So, Rich, what was your first trade?
Yeah, and real quick, just clarification. We mentioned a little bit on the last podcast we did when we said we were going to talk about this topic is. Or no, sorry, that was on that was with what was it? The I Go Hard.
Yeah,
the I Go Hard Now podcast. Yeah, that when we did that, we talked about how one of the things that we wanted to focus on with this podcast is not the we traded a bunch of guys, you know, we traded a bunch of junk for a really good player. We traded a bunch of draft picks for a good player. That's interesting to some people, and there are times where that's fun to talk about in that, but we really wanted to look at ones that were intended at the time to say, hey, you know, we both want to get better. You know, we have this guy, you have this guy, you know, we have these three guys, you have, and let's try to improve our teams. Not the, we're just going to grab these guys so we can suck forever. Like the we're going to grab these guys so we can compete, so we can win this year. I find that way more interesting, especially to see how it works out in hindsight. So that's sort of what we did. If people are kind of curious why these trades seem like a particular breed of deadline trade. So just to clarify there, my first one is February 21st, 2002. And this was, I call it Nick the Quick Comes to Dallas. And this was a trade between the Dallas Mavericks and the Denver Nuggets. It actually featured a lot of like marquee talent at the time. I don't know if all of them were sort of, you know, there are a few that aren't in the peak of their career, but when you look at a trade of good players, I mean, there's a lot of good guys that get moved in here. Just to give you an idea, Dallas Mavericks in this trade, they receive at the end of it Tariq Abdul-Wahad, who at this point was pretty much nothing. And I'm going to go over a recap of kind of what these guys did after this trade. So they get Dallas, Tariq Abdul-Wahad, Avery Johnson, Rafe LaFrenz, and Nick Van Exel. And going to Denver, so this is who Denver is going to receive, is Tim Hardaway, Juwan Howard, Donnell Harvey, and then a 2002 first-round pick, which ended up being Frank Williams from Illinois, and we'll get into him a little bit. One of the things I wanted to look at, and I think you kind of did the same thing too when you look at these trades and why you enjoy them and that sort of stuff, is look at the records of the two teams beforehand and see where these two teams kind of were in their trajectory. And if you're familiar with the date and the time, you understand, hey, 2002, the Mavericks are pretty good. Why are they trading, you know, half of their team or whatever? And yeah, they're 38-17 at this point, and Dallas is making this trade. Denver, less so, almost exactly opposite. They're 16-35. Interesting idea. I mean, the Dallas Mavericks, they ended up going 19-8 the rest of that year. Nick Van Exel obviously wasn't long for that team. Avery Johnson, I'll kind of, you know, actually here, let me run down each guy, you know, one by one to kind of give you an idea, and then I'll go back, I'll trace back and talk a little bit more about them. But obviously one of the big deals was Dallas wanted to get younger quick. They wanted to do a few things. Tim Hardaway wasn't in their plans. They thought Nick Van Exel, more dynamic player. At the time, Nick Van Exel was kind of controversial, though, because he wasn't a very good defensive player, and that would obviously bear true on Dallas. And Dallas went through a nice little 2 or 3 year run where they were just a miserable defensive team under Don Nelson, but would score like crazy. And then we'll talk a little bit about that, because a lot of the stuff that they did the next year kind of plays into this. But kind of going over the guys that Dallas got, Tariq Abdul-Wahad at that point was kind of a shell of what he was. He only played 18 games with the Mavericks, and this was at the absolute tail end of his career, and just never, he never played again after this. Avery Johnson, obviously, had a little bit of a stint with the Mavericks, 65 games. Only had about a 0.5 win shares, but it was during this time that he was starting to get groomed to be Don Nelson's heir apparent, to be a future head coach, to be a future assistant, whatever it may be. He ended up having a little quick stint after this with the Warriors, but immediately upon retiring to the Warriors, he became an assistant with Dallas. And obviously the rest is history, became Dallas's head coach, took him to the NBA Finals, you know, led them to the NBA's best record the year after, and then a first-round exit to Don Nelson's Warriors. So always some fun little stuff that happens there. But obviously this is a big deal for Avery Johnson. This is his first time in Dallas. So it kind of played a big part in Dallas's history. Rafe LaFrenz actually had a really good, or actually rather I'd say a decent run with Dallas. 7.7 win shares. Funny enough, though, he was traded the year after for Antoine Walker. And as I mentioned in my show notes, he was traded for Antoine Walker and his wonderful three-point stroke. Because if you're familiar with what happened when Antoine Walker went to the Dallas Mavericks, well, he shot a lot of threes and shot them and loved them. And that was really the team. Well, actually, it plays right into here. Nick Van Exel, who only had 5.5 win shares with Dallas, so didn't play a huge role with them. He was really big in the playoffs, though. There was a playoff series where I remember he averaged something like 30 points a game. I mean, he was putting over insane games and just being a huge part of them, making pretty improbable runs in the playoffs and setting the stage for kind of the Dallas franchise that we'd see for a while. But the year after, he was traded for Anton Jameson, and that sort of built this new Dallas Mavericks team that at the time when I was a kid, I thought that was the greatest team ever. I thought Anton Jameson, Antoine Walker, Steve Nash, Michael Finley, and Dirk. Come on. Like, this team's going to be awesome. And then Sean Bradley, like, how can this go wrong? And then I forgot, oh, wait, defense is also a part of basketball. I am 13, and I don't know that. I just assume you score and you win. Yeah, but
I'm sure they were a fun video game team.
Oh, they were so good to play in NBA, whatever NBA 2K this would be. NBA 2K, 2K3, right?
I would guess
would that
so,
be
yeah.
At that point? Or 2K4. It'd be 2K4 at that point. I remember, because I played with Dallas anyway at that time. So when this happened, I was like, oh, it's over. Like, so I went online. That was actually my best. Now I do know it's 2K4 because I played that game to death, online and doing stuff like that. And I know I was big. That was my team because I was like, you can't stop this team. And then I watched real games and I was like, wait a minute. Like, why are they giving up 150 points a game? And I was like, all right, yeah, duh, they need defense. So kind of interesting. This trade really did shape Dallas's team for a while and ended up, Antoine Walker and Jameson were not there for long. Big transitions, but this was a weird period in Dallas where, like, it almost seemed every single year they were trying all new things. And then they finally got some stability with Dirk, with Nash for a little bit until he left. But it was basically Dirk that became the true leader of that team eventually. But this here real quick, Denver Nuggets, obviously after this trade, they weren't a good team before and they were equally bad afterwards. They went 11-20 for the rest of the year. Tim Hardaway. Yes, if you don't remember the Tim Hardaway Denver Nuggets run, I will not blame you because he only had 14 games in Denver. His career was winding down fast. He was kind of a nothing at this point. I know he bounced around a few other places before. I think he went to Indiana at one point. But this was kind of the end of the road for Tim Hardaway. One fun fact that I don't remember at all, I don't know if you have any recollection of this. I found this when searching for this. While playing with the Nuggets, Hardaway was suspended for two games and fined $10,000 by the league when he threw a television monitor on the court.
I wonder what brought that up.
I tried to figure that. I couldn't find a video. I couldn't find anything else. I just found this little nugget in like an SI Vault thing that was talking about how he was enraged, so he threw a monitor on the floor. So which has got to be
it's like he's putting the he's like in a wrestling match, like he's throwing the monitor.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Usually, like on the announcer's table, and then he drives Antonio McDice through the table.
Yeah,
or something like that.
Maybe.
And that's why Antonio McDice was always hurt, probably.
Yeah,
so
that makes sense. That logic checks out. Yeah.
But, like, whose monitor did he steal? Like, what guy didn't have a monitor then? That kind of sucks.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Juwan Howard, who obviously was a big part of this trade. I mean, a big star at this point. I'll stop at star.
Let's calm down a little bit.
Yeah. Well, it's just weird. And that's what's always interesting about Juwan Howard is you look at his contracts, you look at what he was and what he should be, and a lot of what you think about. He just never really ever had a run with one team that you were like, yeah, that was really good. He was always weird, though, because he was really, like, okay. He was always very, very good, but just never stuck around with teams. Denver was no exception. He only got 7.6 win shares while with Denver. Not a long tenure. He, after this, moved down to 1 year in Orlando. A year and a half later, he bounced around again, and he was just all over the place. He was never could really put his foot down in any one place, but Denver, he didn't do much here, and that was a big centerpiece of the trade. Donnell Harvey, 3.6 win shares with Denver. Not a bad year and a half run, but it's Donnell Harvey. Who cares? and then the 2002 first-round pick, I wanted to mention Frank Williams, who was out of Illinois, a guard. Interestingly enough, he was traded by the Denver Nuggets with Antonio McDice for a 2003 second round pick, which just happened to be, you know, no name thing or whatever. But who they got was pretty interesting. He was traded to the New York Knicks for Marcus Camby, Nene, and Mark Jackson. So
it all comes around to Mark Jackson.
Mark Jackson, there's a lot of seven. I mean, for a guy that I always think is synonymous with a few teams, like that last like 5 years of his career, just everywhere. He just went I mean, he becomes sort of that Kevin Bacon, you know, the degrees of separation with that, because like, yeah, you know him as a Knick, you know him as a Pacer or whatever, but man, he bounced around a lot at the end, including like multiple times to the Knicks. Yeah, so that he
tried to lead the revolt against John Stockton in Utah.
Oh right, yeah,
totally. Yeah, so he did a lot of things. So
I forgot about that.
Yeah, that was an interesting strategy. Fine.
And I do remember this trade at the time, too, because Nene just came out. Nene was just this, like, fresh-faced, like, Brazilian prospect or whatever. And at that point, it's still like, boo, anybody from America, they can't be good. Like, they're from, you know, so I remember him coming out and people, obviously, in New York, booing him because I know you're shocked that the New York draft crowd would boo somebody. But, yeah, I remember Nene Hilario getting picked and everybody's booing him. And I was laughing. I was like, he looks okay. He looks, like, not bad. Obviously, he's got, like, short hair at the time. And he's like a little fresh-eyed, like 18-year-old, but always kind of funny. That's always a memory that I have, is them just booing him like crazy and him just being like, I don't understand. Like, why am I getting booed? So that's my first trade, is the Nick Van Exel, Juwan Howard, Dallas, Denver mess. And Denver, obviously, it was many, many years before they would actually be pretty good. All those guys were kind of gone, and it would be until they drafted Carmelo Anthony that they really became a consistent winner, because this crop didn't really work out. Nor did the, let's get, Marcus Camby, let's have Antonio McDice. Oh, he gets hurt too much. Let's acquire Marcus Camby and see how that works out. Oh, wait. Damn it. Like, okay. Well. Like, let's get big men who have feet. Like, that's our goal for the next year, is big men with feet. So there you go.
So my first trade is from February 25th, 1988, and it is the Cleveland Cavaliers and Phoenix Suns. Basically, the Suns getting Tyrone Corbin, Mark West, a draft pick that turned into Dan Majerle, and most importantly, Kevin Johnson. And a couple other second round picks that didn't really add up to much, for Larry Nance, Mike Sanders, and a first round pick that turned into Randolph Keys, who I have not heard of. So I'm assuming was not that important.
I was going to make a WCW 2001 joke, but only you and then maybe a few of the people that listen about Mike Sanders, but above average Mike Sanders. But
above average, yeah. So
I'm glad you get that. And then there's going to be like two other people that are like, oh, sweet, an above average Mike Sanders reference. And then 95% of the other people that listen have no idea. So I will stop right now. But
all right, well, that
more throws,
well, that me, was an so. Above average joke, Rich.
Thank you.
This was like part of a huge overhaul for the Suns. They also traded James Edwards to Detroit, and they traded Jay Humphries to Milwaukee for Craig Hodges. Basically, in 24 hours, they brought in 24 players who, along with Tom Chambers, who was a free agent signee, they would go from 54 losses in 1 year to 55 wins the next year and a berth in the Western Conference Finals.
That is gunslinging at its finest.
Yeah, there you go. So they also, they traded coaches. They had Cotton Fitzsimmons as a coach the next year. So they kind of turned it around. They made some Western Conference finals appearances for the next two seasons. Eventually were sort of a mid-50s win team for four straight years, and they traded for Charles Barkley and made the finals in 93 and, you know, made some deep playoff runs again, but obviously never could win a championship. But however, you know, basically, you know, Kevin Johnson, Dan Majerle, and Mark West were, you know, a strong foundation for a perennial playoff team for almost the next decade. So, yeah. You know, definitely a good trade from there. But on the other hand, you know, also a strong trade, I think, from Cleveland's perspective, because Larry Nance was 29 at that point. So he was a sort of an underrated player, I think, but very good defender, athletic, good dunker, and still had a number of years in Cleveland, like three or four more effective years in Cleveland, actually more than that. You had two all-star years and played six and a half seasons in Cleveland. His last year was, he had a lot of injuries, but you know, and they were a franchise that, you know, had a pretty similar strong play for, other than sort of an odd fall off in 91. They, you know, they would always, of course, run into the Bulls, or usually run into the Bulls through the 90s, but they definitely had like a, you know, the Eastern Conference final was run in 92 and, you know, had some tough playoff series. So it was definitely a better trade for Phoenix, but it was a pretty good trade for Cleveland as well. And one tidbit I like on this trade is it's from a New York Times article. When the trade was announced, all the players had to do was change dressing rooms and introduce themselves to their new coaches and change uniforms, because they actually were playing that night of the trade. Of course,
those are the best.
They couldn't actually play for their teams because, you know, they had to clear physicals and stuff. And each team suited up 8 players. But it's kind of funny. Also, at the time, Nance's scoring average was just a bit more than those of West, Corbin, and Johnson combined. So it's just funny how Nance was used at the time versus how the other 3 players were used. And of course they would be a good player. And there's an article from the next season, an AP article talking about, you know, Kevin Johnson's rise to stardom, and he was really good. And at that point, the Cavs had the best record in the East and the Suns had the second best record in the West. And like I said, the Suns made the conference finals that year, but were swept by the Lakers. The Cavs ended up 55-27, but lost to the Bulls in the first round. So, the Cavs, that was Mark Price, Brad Doherty, John Hot Rod Williams, Ron Harbor, and Craig Elo, you know, a strong team. A lot of those guys were drafted in 86. That was a really strong draft for the Sixers. And, you know, I don't know, you know, obviously, like, Kevin Johnson ends up being, you know, having a borderline Hall of Fame career and being a really great player. But, you know, obviously he would have been behind Mark Price in that situation. So I'm not sure that.
Yeah, he's a 21-year-old rookie at this point, too, for people that aren't aware. I mean, he's still young. It's still his rookie year. And he didn't come into the league and was immediately, you know, scoring 20 and a great assister or anything like that. I mean, he was averaging a little.
Yeah, I mean, second year, he did pick it up and became great. Right. But, yeah, it was definitely a trade, I think, that
you could probably assume he was going to be very good, but at the time, it's not like they traded a 20-point-per-game, you know, 19-point-per-game guy. I mean, he was still a rookie, still young. But, yeah, you could sort of assume that it was going to kind of happen, looking at his college numbers and looking at, you know, how quickly then he became a star. But just in case, I mean, just so people know, it wasn't, you know, that he wasn't an obvious budding star or an obvious star at the time.
Yeah, and traded, Nance was, like I said, is a better player than I think he is historically regarded. I mean, he really did have some, you know, some strong seasons, was a really good player. Won the first NBA dunk contest. So
yes, yeah. Was really good. Always a really good dunker. He's one that when I go back and watch, he's always one that his dunks age well.
Yeah.
And he's always got, I'm like, man, he doesn't really get a whole lot of credit. I mean, every year when I watch those old dunk on, I'm like, man, Larry Nance is a really good, like, really good dunker. Then I was looking at his numbers. I'm like, yeah, Larry Nance is a really good player.
Yeah,
like,
he was like 21
and he just kind of get lost in the he's like a one of those dudes that just gets lost in the shuffle of, like, the time when he was around. It was just like, dude, there's no more room for any more stars. Like, there are already too many good ones out there. So it's a little unfortunate, but he's still a good player, though.
You know, everything in the West was overshadowed by the Lakers for most of his
career, right. So I mean, there was Yeah,
exactly.
You weren't gonna get your head above water there. So,
not so much, unfortunately. No. So, all right. Well, what is your next trade?
All right, my next trade is March 11th, 1999. This is I'm titling "Everybody Gets a New Point Guard," and this trade is a massive one. This is a massive 3-team trade. I'm going to break down the guys here real quick, and then I'm going to do some quotes that are pretty interesting about this. I'm going to do less of kind of analysis of what happened before and after, and more of how this trade happened, and one guy in particular that sort of forced his hand with this trade. But the trade is Minnesota. They're receiving, or in the end of this trade, they get Terrell Brandon, Brian Evans, who we'll get Brian Evans is nothing, and then a 1999 first-round pick, which ended up being Wally Szczerbiak. So there you go. The New Jersey Nets in this trade received Chris Carr, Bill Curley, which I can do another Curly Bill WCW reference. Boom, that's two.
Nice.
In case you're curious.
Good.
Elliot Perry, and then Stephon Marbury. So big trade. So essentially Minnesota, Terrell Brandon, New Jersey, Stephon Marbury. We'll go into that. Milwaukee, out of this trade, they received Paul Grant, Sam Cassell, and Chris Gatling. So they actually got two decent players there in Sam Cassell and Chris Gatling, and then Paul Grant, who wasn't nothing. But it's kind of an interesting trade. I know I was looking through the SI vault to see, and Jackie McCollum does an awesome piece on how this trade became, who wanted this trade to happen, what the GMs thought, and in particular, Kevin McHale, who was the Minnesota GM at the time, pulls absolutely no punches in the fact that they were not happy about having to make this trade. But essentially, that Stephon Marbury all but forced them to do it, and his agent, David Falk, who's very famous for, you know, being Michael Jordan's agent and that sort of stuff, and how he sort of forced it as well.
Yeah.
So interesting sort of stuff. So I want to read a few of the quotes.
Richard Furey said, I can't imagine a player trying to demand a trade, you know, this day and age. That would never happen.
Oh, I know. It's ridiculous. I mean, that can you imagine, like, imagine you're a point guard on a team that looks like it has a chance to be good or you know, possibly, you know, was good last year in the West, but just can't get, you know, slightly above water. And then you're going to request a trade. It's unbelievable.
It is. It is literally unbelievable.
I refuse to believe it. So anyway, so here's kind of the quotes. And Jackie, like I said, did an awesome, awesome job with this. And I can link it if people are interested, and just tweet at us if you're interested. Or if you just go to SI Vault and look up Stephon Marbury trade or something, I think it's going to come up right away. Here's what it is. The Coney Island native forced the Timberwolves to trade him to New Jersey last Thursday after providing them with a short list of acceptable destinations: New York, New Jersey, or Los Angeles. My, how times have changed, thankfully.
Yes.
Marbury, though, through his agent, David Falk, forced Minnesota's hands by threatening to walk at season's end and sign with the Bulls. Thank God that didn't happen. Wait till you see what this awesome power team that David Falk was trying to put together here. He couldn't believe Marbury, he is Kevin McHale, would forsake a team that was developing into a championship contender for Dynasty in the Ruins. And Dynasty in the Ruins, obviously, is New Jersey. Upon hearing that McHale was prepared to call Marbury's bluff, Falk, who refused to deal with McHale, informed Minnesota owner Glenn Taylor, "I can put together my own team in Chicago." The implication was that Falk would dump his stable of free agents, among them Stephon Marbury, Nets guard Kerry Kittles, and Cavaliers center Vitaly Potapenko, into the lap of Chicago manager Jerry Krause.
Yeah. Good old,
does that team win more than 30 games? Like
the good old MKP, you know, tandem, the famous Marbury, Kittles, and Potapenko.
like that's your threat. Like, well, I'll just create the super team if you don't do it. Like,
yeah,
that team would not win more than 30 games.
Well, maybe no in the, maybe in 99 of the lockout year they would have won.
Maybe the team is no good. Vitaly Potapenko, that's your bargaining chip. Well, you know what? I'm going to take Vitaly Potapenko elsewhere if that's what we're going to do here. So,
yeah.
All right. Last quote here. There's no denying Marbury's talent, but there is room to question his priorities and his commitment to winning. Marbury told SI in January 1998 that he was thinking of bolting Minnesota, his contract was up, because of the weather and because he missed his New York friends. The news stunned the Minnesota Timberwolves front office, which later discovered that Marbury had made those comments just days after a local nightclub spot refused to serve him alcohol because he was underage. His quote then was, "They give me my own table in New York," Marbury reportedly fumed between expletives.
Yes.
So he was upset that they would not let him drink underage. And then there was another interesting quote I tweeted out earlier.
To be fair, what else is there to do in Minnesota besides drink?
I'm the Mall of America.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
You can go to Hulk Hogan's Pasta Mania, which I'm assuming is still there. So
I'm assuming. Why would it not still be there?
I mean, fast food pasta at the Mall of America.
Sounds pretty good. I'm just kidding, Minnesota. I've never actually been to Minnesota. Well,
no, I don't know. I drove through. It's probably a fine town.
It's great. I watched Fargo last night, so it just made me think of cold. So.
Yeah, I don't like it. Cold's no good. It's like 5 degrees outside right now.
Yeah, it's going to be like negative like 25 tomorrow.
Yeah, that's tomorrow.
Wind chill wise, yeah. So
yeah, we're going to get killed tomorrow. So anyway, there was one last quote that I wanted to bring up, and it's Kevin McHale just kind of turning the knife on Marbury. There was a quote where Marbury said he didn't want to be in Minnesota because he felt like he wasn't on TV enough, like he wasn't in, you know, a star or whatever. And McHale said, you know, it's not where you play, it's if you win. Well, you know, when you win, you get on TV. That's basically what it is. And they said, like, Steph just kind of shrugged it off and said, no, I'm going to be, you know, it's New York, it's New Jersey, that's where my friends are, all that sort of stuff. So McHale responds with, I wonder if Steph has noticed the Nets are 3-15. If he wants to be on TV with them, he better get cable.
There you go.
That's an NBA GM.
Yeah. He's
swinging a.
Well, McHale wasn't exactly known for being a diplomat. So.
No. So that's just.
Yeah.
Just burying the Nets. I'm assuming he didn't make too many more trades with the Nets after that, but maybe not. I don't know. But real quickly here, as mentioned, the New Jersey Nets were 3-15. Jason, do you know who their head coach was at this time?
Well, I know because you have it written down right here.
Oh, you're looking. Notes, damn
but,
it. I don't see your little scroller. I don't see the Google Docs scroller.
Oh, yeah, I'm very sneaky. I probably could have guessed, but John Calipari.
Yes, the old famous John Calipari was he was fired two losses later, and that's where 3-15 at this time.
His team is better now.
Yes, this current team is much better. Almost better than Kentucky, the current New Jersey Nets.
Yeah, Kentucky. I hear people who talk about college basketball say they're good. I don't watch college basketball, but
they're a fun team to watch because they what happened was and I very very minimally, so I'm probably completely wrong about this, and someone can tell me, but I watch a little bit, and especially I try to watch them as much as I can, because essentially what happened was Calipari, and you know what he does, he brings in these crop of guys that he knows are going to the NBA or whatever. Well, he assumed all of his crop last year was going to go to the NBA, so he brings in this like awesome class of guys, and like half his dudes stay, so he's got like 15 guys that are really good. And like 10 of them are like all staters and like all Americans. And so he just runs out like rotations of five, just like five all Americans just come out. And like, it's just unbelievable the depth that they have. Like anyone on their bench is better than everybody else on any other team. Like it's just, it's ridiculous how good they are. And there's like a few guys, you know, like Jahlil Okafor and Duke or whatever, but pretty much like there's a reason they're 24-0 or 25-0 or whatever it is right now. I mean, they're a powerhouse, but real quickly, Minnesota Timberwolves, They get a little bit, they do okay. This was a team that was okay for a while and was really looking to get on that next cusp, and that was the big thing, is that Marbury and Garnett was going to be it. And obviously it didn't happen, and ended up being Terrell Brandon. And Terrell Brandon was for most of his career, a really good player. The big problem with him is health, and he never quite got there. He had a 23.1 win shares with Minnesota, though, which is pretty damn good considering that, you know, he's largely considered just, you know, being so injury prone. One of the interesting parts about this, though, and it was mentioned in another SI article, is this season, you know, his tenure, his run with the Wolves coincided with Chauncey Billups coming to the Wolves. And a big part of what Billups said made him a great point guard was sitting there and talking and learning from Terrell Brandon. So that's a very interesting part that he can always kind of look fondly on that. Brian Evans, he played 24 minutes for the Wolves and was waived like 2 days later. So that didn't do too much. The 1999 first round pick turned into Wally Szczerbiak, who's a huge part of the Timberwolves, you know, success throughout the mid-2000s. 41 win shares total as a member of the Wolves. And a fact that you brought up about a week or so ago, he set at one point the Timberwolves franchise record with 44 points, and this was on April 13th, 2003. It was since been broken by Kevin Love, and then who else broke it this year, sir?
Corey Brewer broke it last year, and then Mo Williams.
Oh, that's right.
And then Mo Williams broke it this year, and this is the first, I can only assume this is the first time that a team has traded its two franchise scoring leaders in the same season.
Someone can look that up. I try to look it up. I don't know how the hell you could figure that out. That's got to be an Elias like Sports Bureau thing. Like, just have somebody just pour over books to try to
figure
it out.
This is the Jason Sports Bureau, buddy.
Yeah, and no, I agree. Look, how could that possibly happen any other time? Like, you know what I mean? Like, that'd be really hard to happen.
It would be difficult.
And it can only be a franchise like the Wolves or something like that. But,
sure.
But anyway, the New Jersey Nets, obviously, after this trade, I'm not going to go over Chris Carr, Bill Curley, and Elliot Perry. You don't care about them. They don't matter. Stephon Marbury, maybe you care about them in case one of them is listening. Thank you for listening. But yes. In case Elliot Perry is listening, I apologize. Stephon Marbury, though, obviously his Nets tenure, 19.2 win shares. He became an all-star and became sort of a household name. People were more aware of Stephon Marbury in New Jersey, so he was kind of right in that respect. But the Nets didn't get, you know, dramatically better with him. They were okay, but they weren't that good. He ended up getting moved to Phoenix for Jason Kidd. And obviously when Jason Kidd came, coupled with Richard Jefferson and Kenyon Martin, that's when the Nets went to consecutive NBA Finals, became a pretty good team, a team that I think benefited from a very weak East, because that team is not really good. And obviously their finals appearances proved that they weren't very good because they got beat pretty good. But Stephon Marbury obviously has turned, went to New York, had a bunch of issues there, but has turned, parlayed that into a legendary career, like an absolutely legendary career in Chinese basketball, the Chinese Basketball Association. I believe he has statues of him. And he's like, if you look at his playoff, like point per game, there's like one year where he had like 37 points in the playoffs. Like that's just, I love it. I'd love to see a lot of video of Stephon Marbury playing in Chinese
basketball. I'm sure it exists.
Because I'm sure, yeah, I've seen a little bit of clips. I've never seen like a full game. I've just seen like highlights or whatever. Yeah. But he seems like he's had, I mean, hell of a time. I mean, I'm glad that because he was a guy, I mean, really was always sort of taken very weird in America. Nobody really knew how to handle him. He was sort of a, I don't want to, because he wasn't really a bad boy in that sense, but he was sort of, you know how I'm trying to, I don't know like, how to describe
maybe
him.
Maybe flaky?
Yeah, I guess that's the right word. Yeah. Like, he wasn't a bad guy. There wasn't anything bad about him, but he was just, like, people couldn't get a handle on him. And they mentioned, even in this article, Kevin McHale just mentions on, like, a daily basis, you weren't sure what Marbury you were going to get. Like, sometimes he was super hyper-focused and was great, and then other times he was just floaty, and it was like, you never knew what you were going to get out of the guy. But, no, I'm happy to hear about that.
Yeah.
Milwaukee, obviously, this trade was a big deal for them because Sam Cassell coming to there. Paul Grant played 5 minutes, so that was pretty awesome. Chris Gatling, he only played 30 games for them, bounced around the league for a little bit after that. But Sam Cassell played a big part in Milwaukee's history. You got 38.6 win share, or 36.2 win shares, and then obviously on the mid 2000s or the early 2000s Bucks, they almost reached the NBA Finals in 2001. And Sam Cassell at this point basically firmly established himself as a top tier point guard in the league. Would then go to a few other teams throughout his career. You know, really just be a staple of the NBA after that. I mean, he was to a point before that, but this was, I thought the Milwaukee run was one of his better runs, and one that I'm kind of synonymous with him. I thought when he really sort of put it all together was that run. But
yeah, absolutely. And of course then had some success in Minnesota later.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. We'd go to Minnesota and form that team. I really wanted that team to win. There was that year with Charles Sprewell was awesome. Cassell was great. Wally's World was.
Yeah. And Garnett, of course.
Oh, those Timberwolves. It's probably because their jerseys were so bad.
There you go.
If they didn't have trees on the side of their jerseys, they probably could have won.
They probably would have, yeah. But that's the lesson. Very few teams win a championship with a bad jersey.
Right. I mean, yeah, you look at the Vancouver Grizzlies. Proof, trees do not equal. No, just don't have trees. No trees.
I recommend not having trees in a jersey, yeah. So my second trade is infamous day in Atlanta Hawks franchise history, where the Hawks traded a Dominique Wilkins and a 1994 first round pick, which later turned into Greg Minor. I know Greg Minor fans, a lot of them here, for Danny Manning, to the Clippers for Danny Manning. So this is weird because the Hawks were 36-16. They were in a tie for the best record in the East. And the Hawks have tried, they are apparently the only team in NBA history to trade their leading scorer while having the best record in their conference.
That's so Hawks.
Now, he was 34 at the time. Yeah. They were, he was coming off, he'd torn his ACL the year before or come back from it the year before. So he'd had, you know, within the previous year or two. Had come back from it, was still playing well, but was, you know, at a point in his career where, you know, he wasn't going to be carrying the team for too much longer. So it did make sense to think about the future a little bit. And Danny Manning had actually played pretty well, led the Clippers to a couple of playoff seasons with Larry Brown there. They made it for the first time in 16 years in 92, back when they were the Buffalo Braves. So it's a trade where the perception has gotten much worse with age. But on the other hand, in many ways, it is still very baffling. It's funny reading the quotes of the time, because Dominique has talked about, like, you know, just how horribly disappointed he was by doing it. He always wanted to be in Atlanta. And so on and so forth. But, you know, quotes of the time are, say, oh, the reception has been unbelievable. They've given me more respect here than I ever got in Atlanta. I always wanted to be in LA. The Clippers have talent, but you need leadership, someone to step forward. I will do that for the Clippers. Obviously, like, he's just making the best of it or whatever, but it's funny to hear him talk about it now versus what he said then. Another interesting thing is that Manning, depending on who you asked, apparently they traded for Manning, who was going to be a free agent as well, they obviously didn't come to a formal agreement with him, but it is baffling in retrospect that they, because one thing they say that they thought that they would sign him, and then later, apparently, their GM, Pete Babcock, who's sort of infamously a bad GM in Atlanta and Toronto, later was quoted as saying that Lenny and I are disappointed that Danny is not coming back, but we were prepared for it. We made the trade with the understanding he wouldn't be back, which is just like...
We just wanted those 4 months of sure. Danny Manning, just because they'd be fun.
They thought, well, I guess they thought that Manning, who was like 8 years younger, would be better for the playoff run. And the funny thing about that is that there's an SI article from the time right after the trade, and the quotes are almost hilarious from it. I'm going to paraphrase it. Where Wilkins is a small forward who can fill up the basket. Manning he's 27. Versatile, he's 6'10" front court player who can fill up an entire box score, and says, where Wilkins and Willis often clashed over the ball, Manning welcomes help with the scoring load, and where Wilkins was the human highlight film, Manning is the living instructional video. So sound and aware that Lenny Wilkins envisions running much of the offense through him once he learns it. It's really funny to see Danny Manning sort of be as, you know, like as Wilkins be portrayed as like this petulant, you know, gunner, and and Manning be like this, you know, panacea, this great, you know, like, oh, we're going to share the ball with him. Yeah, that's how you described Tim Duncan. It's hilarious that in retrospect, that being the way that it was at least viewed in this article, you know, very briefly.
And it's a good trade. Honestly, it's a good trade if you sign Danny Manning. If you, with the implicit idea of, hey, let's sign Danny Manning for the long term or something, like, you know, it's, you have something worked out or, you know, yeah. then it's a no-doubter.
It's a good basketball trade in that respect, although giving up the first-round pick might be a bit much, but... it's a good basketball trade, but just from a perspective of, like, you know, Wilkins has been the guy who's just, like, by far the greatest, or at least, you know, the most famous, the greatest Atlanta Hawk of all time. To treat him that way, to trade him to the you know, the dregs of the NBA, to the worst team, you know, for doing that, that obviously is like a terrible, you know, PR move, just in Atlanta. The Hawks still affects the relationship with the Hawks have with the city to this day, you know, so from that perspective. But I do agree with you, like, it's a defensible basketball trade if they are able to keep Manning, who would have played pretty well. Now, they were able to kind of rebuild a couple of summers later. They get Dikembe Mutombo, they have Ogman, they get Steve Smith, and they're able to kind of have a decent run in the later half of the 90s. So they're able to kind of emerge from this without too much damage being done. But, you know, it is, but at least from a, you know, a perspective of just, you know, losing their top star and, you know, losing, you know, the best thing that they had going on, you know, it was a terrible trade from that perspective.
Yeah, and yeah, it's hard to lose though. The face of the franchise trades are always tough. I mean, I don't know if there's ever a really good time to do them.
Yeah,
and in this case, I mean,
one time it is not a good time to do them is when you're in first place.
Where it's like, where you can sort of, in a lot of ways they do this. A lot of franchises do this where they'll sort of spin it, even if the guy doesn't agree. They're like, you know, we wanted to have him have a chance to make the playoffs, or, oh, his career's winding, you know, we wanted him to get one last chance at an NBA Finals run, or something like that, you know. But that's not really what happened here. It was kind of like, and honestly, yeah, it wasn't a bad basketball trade, but yeah, when you don't re-sign the guy and you only last 4 months of them, so you traded, you know, one of your franchise's most iconic players for 4 months of Danny Manning, that's not so good. But right, exactly. Atlanta's going to Atlanta.
I mean, Manning was actually pretty good. I mean, and he was pretty good afterward, although he had some injuries later. And, you know, it was pretty good for Phoenix. But, it didn't work out well.
No, it was unfortunate for them. But,
Wilkins did, he was able to go back with his former coach from the Hawks, Bob Weiss, who was the Clippers coach. So,
there you go. Yeah, okay. Good.
Nice reading for them. So, all right. So what is your last trade?
Well, here, this one is another one that didn't go particularly well for a lot of the same reasons as the Danny Manning one. So it's good that we kind of segued from these two. And I call this one Jesus Leaves Milwaukee. This is February 20th, 2003, and this is the trade, the famous one, Ray Allen, Gary Payton. Here's the guys that kind of went on the move here. Seattle received in this trade Ray Allen, Ronald Flitmurray, Kevin Ollie, and then a 2003 first-round pick, which turned into Luke Ridnour. And then Milwaukee received out of this trade Gary Payton and Desmond Mason. So, interestingly enough, when I picked this trade, I just kind of picked it because it's always been one that's interesting for me. This is a, you know, an interesting idea that you know, they trade, you know, Milwaukee trades a franchise corner, or, you know, to that point, a franchise cornerstone in Ray Allen, a guy who, you know, nearly got them to the NBA Finals for a while, a guy that was synonymous in the early part of his career with, you know, Milwaukee. And then Seattle trades an absolute franchise cornerstone in Gary Payton, a famous player. I mean, a famous throughout the 90s, NBA Finals, that's what we're talking about. I mean, Gary Payton, you think Gary Payton, you probably should think the Seattle Supersonics. If you think, you know, anything else, I look at you poorly. But, you know, I mean, he's sort of synonymous with that franchise and that, you know, everything that comes with it. So to have this trade go down, it was very interesting. It almost seemed like kind of a challenge trade. I wasn't exactly sure why it happened. So in my research, I looked up, and I always kind of assumed that Milwaukee was getting rid of Ray Allen for whatever purposes they were. And I remember there was some issues with George Karl at the time. But I was never even sure why Milwaukee wanted to take on Gary Payton. I thought, okay, you know what? They were bringing on an older Gary Payton because they wanted his contract to expire because he was an unrestricted free agent. And then he was going to expire, and they were going to use that extra cap space and kind of rebuild and do that sort of stuff because they had faltered a little bit. But then when I look up in the SI Vault, which is why the SI Vault is the greatest thing ever, I come to find out that Milwaukee wanted Gary Payton. So Milwaukee GM Ernie Grunfeld called Seattle and said, what would it take to get Gary Payton? Seattle responded back with Ray Allen, assuming, you know, like, hey, Ray Allen, yeah, you know, and then Ernie Grunfeld called him back and said, yeah, let's talk. Let's do Ray Allen, you know, Gary Payton, let's talk about some numbers. So always a really fascinating thing to me. What sort of happened, a lot of the reasons, Bucks coach George Karl did not like Ray Allen. He even mentions in this quote that he was a scorer with little interest in sharing the ball or playing defense. So kind of interesting that George Karl never really quite got it. He said there was a lack of effort sometimes from him. There was just issues. And George Karl has since apologized and said he should have been, you know, a bigger man. He kind of jumped to conclusions by saying that, whatever. But, you know, you have the Bucks trading, you know, Ray Allen to get Gary Payton. And then very interesting because, yeah, they thought that they were going to get, you know, they thought they wanted Gary Payton. And I cannot fathom that because obviously as an unrestricted free agent, he bolted Milwaukee the year after. I mentioned this on Twitter earlier today, so I'm glad Paul Henning, who does some work for the Save Our Bucks campaign, the SaveOurBucks.com and that stuff, he follows us, and he actually responded to me with a few different things and said, you know, ugh, you know, don't bring that up. I hate hearing about that. And I asked him, I said, you know, you probably knew at the time, what the hell were they thinking getting Gary Payton, who was a restricted free or an unrestricted free agent? Like, why would he stay in Milwaukee? And apparently, according to him, he said he is Gary Payton, told Ernie Grunfeld that he could bring Karl Malone to Milwaukee as well. He asked the Bucks for a 4-year, $40 million extension and guaranteed Malone would sign there too. In case you're not familiar with what time period, Karl Malone and Gary Payton decided, hey, let's go to Los Angeles and team up with Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal and see how that works instead of going to Milwaukee.
Yes.
And they made the NBA Finals, and obviously that's a team that's historically like, oh, they failed, and let's, like, well, they got to the NBA Finals. Like, that's
right.
I was like, because people do that with like the Miami Heat that first year too. They're like, oh, look at the big three's a failure, and I'm like, they're in the NBA Finals. Like, that's really hard to do.
Yes,
like that's pretty damn good that they were like, hey, let's get a team together and go to the NBA Finals, or like, let's win a championship. And it's like, oh, they were, you know, four games short of winning the NBA. I'm like, that's pretty good. Like,
it's not too bad.
I think that's not a bad goal to have in mind. So obviously, the Karl Malone, Gary Payton, Bucks dynasty did not happen, but that would have been sweet. I don't know why Ernie Grunfeld thought that would happen.
Maybe just the terrible uniforms. They were like, oh, we can't wear the uniforms. I'm sorry.
These purple uniforms.
No, we can't do that. No.
Then again, they wore purple. No, I guess, yeah. No.
Yeah, well, I guess.
You do.
Well, the Sonics had bad uniforms, but then too, and the Jazz did. So yeah, that
you really could escape bad uniforms.
They were getting a little better by then, but yeah, it was not a good uniform situation for the most part. Yeah. Now I will say that Ray Allen was a little bit, maybe not expendable isn't quite the right word, but they did have Michael Redd waiting in the wings, who was really surprisingly very good, was a second round pick. So it did sort of make sense to move Allen to get playoff time. But yeah, you know, Gary Payton, who was still really good then, but was 34 and it turns out didn't want to stick around. So
believe it or not.
Yeah.
No. And at the time, I think we always had this perception of what Ray Allen is now. And he really didn't have that at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, he always, and I think it played out later when he, you know, he went to Seattle and they didn't have a ton of success afterwards. They made, you know, they played the playoffs 1 year, 150 games, you know, one of the years as well. But when you see him go to Boston, you understand that's probably the best for Ray Allen. Or you see what he did in Miami is him being the featured guy, him being the number one guy probably wasn't the best move. And he excelled at just being the second or third option, being that guy who could sort of stay away from the ball and just be ready to, you know, catch and shoot and do that sort of stuff. Once he does that with Boston and once he does that with Miami or whatever, then you kind of see, aha, you know, that's what Ray Allen is. If you're at the time, I mean, George Karl was, you know, he sort of gets a bad rap, but it was sort of justified in the point too, where him as the featured guy wasn't really, you know, Milwaukee couldn't get over that hump. They got, you know, games within the NBA Finals in 2001, and then just they started to falter, and Karl sort of made the move. But like the Danny Manning thing, it kind of hurts when then you don't sign Gary Payton. And then I thought, okay, cool, you just wanted to get, you know, cap space, but then they realized, hey, we wanted, I wonder if that was sort of revisionist history that I'm saying, no, we wanted Gary Payton, but I don't know. Like, this was done at, you know, close to the time of the trade. So I have no reason to believe they'd be, you know, lying about that. But anyway, the fortunes of the teams, Michael Redd, as you've mentioned, became the leader of the Bucks for a while. They made the playoffs. They've made it since this trade four times. They made the playoffs. Never gotten out of the first round, though, so they never have really had the success that they had with that Ray Allen, you know, Glenn Robinson, Sam Cassell team that they had. But Milwaukee's rebuilding, and they're on a good path these days. I think they're finally sort of figuring it out and getting it together, and they have real talent for the first time in a long time. Yeah. Gary Payton has mentioned 28 games with Milwaukee, unrestricted free agent, signs with the Lakers alongside Karl Malone, who, you know, they did not go to Milwaukee. They instead went to the Lakers, and they made it the NBA Finals and were within a few games of winning it. Obviously, the Detroit Pistons beat them, a team that we talked about a little bit earlier. And then Desmond Mason, who went to the Bucks as well. He spent 2.5 years in Milwaukee and was kind of a pseudo star for the franchise. I remember a pretty big deal when I went to Bucks games at the time. Like, he was obviously famous for his dunk contest dunks, and he was okay. He was probably the second or third option on the team, but a pretty decent player.
Didn't he get hurt?
He did. He tore his ACL one of the years, if I remember correctly. Okay. And that always sort of, ever since then, he kind of became, he actually turned into a pretty good shooter for a while as well. So he had a pretty interesting career. One thing that's interesting about Desmond Mason, though, and, you know, I mentioned 2003 first round pick was also in this trade, and it was Luke Ridenour. A few years later, Desmond Mason and Luke Ridenour were traded for each other, and it was these two teams trading those guys to the other one. So it was Desmond Mason, who at the time was an Oklahoma City Thunder member, getting traded to or who was on Milwaukee, getting traded to the Oklahoma City Thunder for Luke Ridenour, who was getting traded to Milwaukee. So I thought that was kind of fun, interesting as well.
A big
so
circle of life
a few right years, now. yeah, exactly. What a circle of life. Seattle, obviously, they won 52 games in 2004-05. 3 years later, they would move to Oklahoma City and obviously become the Thunder, and the rest is history there. Ray Allen had a decent career with Seattle, 38.2 win shares. Eventually moved on to Boston and did, you know, everything that Ray Allen would do. Around Flip Murray, he had a quote-unquote breakout 2003-2004, which I always remember people really calling it a big deal and that was a breakout. I went back and looked at the season. He was no damn good. Like, he was just a no-name that had, like, 15 points a game. But, like, he had 1.7 win shares. Like, he was a score or nothing. Like, he did absolutely nothing else but that. So I remember at the time that was a big deal because he was scoring so much, but he wasn't really very good. So.
He was a poor man's Jamal Crawford for the Hawks in 2009 before they got the real Jamal
Crawford. And like he would bounce around a lot of teams would bring him up. I remember the Bulls brought him in, you know, Cleveland brought him in with LeBron that one year. It was like, here, you got Flip Murray now, and they're like,
yeah,
he's not good. Like, they're like, no, he's good. And like, he never was, and like, he flipped around. He was like at six different teams at the end of his career, and the reason was because everybody thought this year was good, and he wasn't any damn good this year. So that's the Flip Murray. Sorry, Flip.
He did have other than 1 year in Seattle, he had a career high PER in the Hawks. It was 14.7.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
it was 15 points.
I remember that.
15.4 in 2004 for the Sonics. So that was pretty good.
Was he a bench chucker for the Hawks, or was
he
didn't start?
No,
right?
He didn't start. Yeah, he was the sixth man. I mean, he was fine in that role for that year. Then it did not last after that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I remember a fat Flip Murray throwing up shots for the Bulls in like 2009-2010.
There
it was,
you go.
Awful. It was like, nice. It was a team that was obviously like getting better, and like there was pieces there, and it was like Flip Murray, and it was like, let's stop, just go away. Yeah. And like, he eventually did. But Vinny Del Negro, I believe, liked him. So Kevin Ollie, who didn't do too much there, he played 770 minutes with Seattle. He's now obviously the head coach of the storied UConn basketball team, so he's obviously moved on to a pretty good career. And Luke Ridenour, as mentioned, 2003 first round pick that was traded in this. Over four seasons with Seattle, he had 14.1 win shares, but then ironically, as I mentioned, moved on to the Milwaukee Bucks and had a decent career with the Milwaukee Bucks too. So he's carved out a really good career, Luke Ridenour. He's done now, right? Or is he still hanging around?
He's on the Magic.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I remember seeing him now. Yeah, I mean,
I think he plays over younger, better players.
Yes, that is.
Well, maybe not now that they have a new coach.
Yeah, oh, that's true. Yeah, that was a big reason. But yeah, he's carved out a nice little niche. I mean, he was never. And you really
only,
could assume
he's only that. Actually played 442 minutes, so he hasn't played that much. But
okay, all right. Well,
31 that's games. I don't know if he's been hurt or not, but
he probably doesn't deserve to play that many games anymore. But yeah, decent career for him. So and as mentioned, ironically enough, he was traded for Desmond Mason, you know, in this trade. So a very interesting trade. Yeah, it was something that I went in not knowing, and then I learned that Milwaukee actually wanted Gary Payton, and then to find out that they assumed that Gary Payton and Karl Malone were going to come to Milwaukee in the mid-2000s.
Yeah,
so that's very cute.
Optimistic.
That's cute. I like that. Yeah.
Hey, you know,
I enjoy that.
Optimistic Ernie.
Like, those are two like stars. Like, and they were clearly title hunting at that time. I remember when those free agent thing went down. I mean, Karl Malone was flat out just like, I want to win a title. I have like X years left. Like, you don't go to Malone. Like,
I mean, I don't know.
Right?
With how weak the East was, I mean, I guess if you added Malone and Payton, you know, like, I guess theoretically maybe you could have had, You know, like they could have been in contention to win the East the next year. I mean, it's not they're like a 500 team without those guys. So
sure,
if Michael Redd, you know, is a good scorer, that's not a bad team actually. But yeah. I mean, they're obviously not what the Lakers ended up being. Even though that was,
I don't know if Joe Smith and Shaq are 1-1, but you know,
right? Yeah, but
Brian Skinner and Shaq, obviously, when you combine those two, oh, they had Tim Thomas, I forgot, old Timmy Thomas.
Oh, yeah, old TT,
one of my favorite players of all time. I don't know why,
that's kind of weird.
Like, people have like Ricky Davis as their like kind of like ironic like player that they like. Tim Thomas is always some of mine, it's just like, just no damn good, really. Just like good at a few things, yeah. And like really thought he was awesome and like just fun to watch, but man, he. Yeah, not very.
Mine's good, probably, right? Tyronn Lue. So,
okay, well, yeah, I like that one.
Yeah,
thanks. I like Tyronn Lue.
Yeah. So my final pick is the 2007 January 16, 2007 trade between the Golden State Warriors and the Indiana Pacers, where the Warriors received Steven Jackson, Al Harrington, Sarunas Yavikavish, and Josh Powell. For Mike Dunleavy, Troy Murphy, Ike Diogu, and Keith McLeod. This was basically, you know, neither one of these teams liked what they had, so they decided, yeah, we'll just swap our problems and see how it works out.
Those are the best trades.
Yeah, basically, Dunleavy and Murphy didn't really fit in with Don Nelson's system. Nelson had just become the coach of the team that year. The Pacers were still kind of reeling from the Malice in the Palace situation. Steven Jackson had been suspended for that. He'd also recently gotten in trouble the previous season for a fight in a strip club, and then had a spat with Rick Carlisle, who was their coach at the time. Harrington had come back from the Hawks, signed with the Pacers, but he didn't really fit alongside Jermaine O'Neal very well. They both kind of played the same position. So they decided to trade issues, and that actually ended up freeing a bunch of money up for the Warriors too, because Murphy and Dunleavy had way more on their contracts left than Jackson and Harrington did, which is hilarious to realize today. But I mean, you know, Murphy was a big man. I mean, he rebounded pretty well and he could shoot threes, but he didn't do much else. And Dunleavy was kind of a underachiever most of his career. He's a decent role player now, but you know, it was just not a was it kind of another like Great White hype that didn't end up working out too well. Also, the what has often been noted is the Indiana getting two white guys. It just, it's sort of a pattern of Indiana trading and drafting white guys for a while.
Oh, at this time? Yes. It was a while. This was the most annoying, like grindy, it was like the most white team ever too. I remember, you know, just watching them in playoff series or whatever. And like, yeah, they had like six white dudes that would just come off, and like, they were just, they were such,
yeah.
And it was kind of the running joke, but it was like, it played out pretty good.
Utah and Indiana always had that, like, oh, the white guy's going to be on there. They're going to draft for them. And that just, it always kind of ended up happening that way. But right. The funny thing is that there's ESPN analysis, and John Hollinger thought that Ike Diogu going to the Pacers made them the winner in the trade, because Ike Diogu was actually like a really good permanent player for a while, but yeah. You know, just he had injuries and, you know, he didn't play very much. I think he got in foul trouble a lot, but this was kind of not the early days exactly, but this was when, before a lot of the other advanced metrics were out besides PER, at least that were like popular and used, you know, a lot. So that was, you know, it was still kind of, you know, advanced statistics, at least being used by fans and by writers, was still kind of in its infancy. So it was right. Like, we didn't have that much to go on yet.
Here's the whitest. I found the whitest Indiana team, and the one that I hated so much. It was the 2010-2011 Indiana Pacers. Uh-huh. They had Danny Granger and Derek Collison and Roy Hibbert and all those sort of guys, and, sure. And Paul George, young Paul George at this point. But I remember this
it little... Hansbrough, right?
It had Tyler Hansbrough, who was annoying, like the most annoying. It had Mike Dunleavy, Josh McRoberts, and Jeff Foster.
Oh,
and there was a point,
yeah.
I went to a Bulls playoff game against them, and there was a point where all, like, those guys were just rotating in and out. I think Jeff Foster came in and just did a hard foul. And then, like, Tyler Hansbrough came in and elbowed somebody. And then, like, Mike Dunleavy was just running around and hitting threes. And I was like, I hate this team. Like, they're so annoying. They're just, like, so white. And they're, like, hustling to every loose ball and just being, you know, grindy. And it was just like, God, this team's annoying. And, like, Jeff Foster's terrible. Come on. Like, yeah. I hate Jeff Foster.
The most obnoxious anyway. I've ever been at an NBA game, I went to a Pacers game, and I had a few beers, and they're playing the Hawks. And yeah, I mean, I wasn't obnoxious to the point of like cursing or yelling, but I was like heckling Mike Dunleavy a little bit, you know, just like that. I think I kept saying that he was too slow. And I think he was playing against Josh Childress, or I forget the particulars now, but I was, you know, chanting that he was too slow. And then he made like 5 3-pointers, like in a quarter. And
right.
And somebody in the, another fan around me said, he's not too slow now, is he? And I'm like, well,
yeah,
you know,
shut up. Yeah. You're only feeling him.
Like, yes. So yeah, that was my favorite.
Screw that Pacers ever. Team. Yeah. Worst team ever.
Yeah. So, yeah, so of course, it didn't really work out that well for the Pacers, at least not initially, but they were able to sort of rebuild, become a decent team under Danny Granger as their star, and then a very good team with Paul George as their star in the next few years. But it worked very well for the Warriors, who that year put together a great 30-game stint toward the end of the season. And then Baron Davis had been picked up the year before. So Jackson, there's kind of a Grantland feature, talks about, you know, it's a career feature on Stephen Jackson, but one of them is talking about how, you know, Jackson was a guy who pushed Baron Davis to play to his talent. And they pulled off we talked about earlier, the 2007 upset the 67 win Mavericks in 07. Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten this, but Stephen Jackson was ejected in games 2 and 5 in the series, but then scored 33 points in the clinching game and also defended Dirk very well, despite the size yes. difference. And there's a blog by Tim Kawakami, the beat writer for Mercury News, just saying that basically it balanced the roster, finally gave Baron some guys who could fight and scrap alongside him. And sort of gave unifying the vets as guys with getting third and second chances and guys who fit Don Nelson's system as well. So it was really a fabulous trade on all those fronts. And, you know, everybody there behaved well, at least for a couple of seasons before Davis left to go to the Clippers and Jackson started causing problems and got traded to Charlotte. But apparently Chris Mullin, his third big move after Baron Davis in this trade, was going to be trading for Kevin Garnett on draft night in 2007. But apparently that got botched by ownership and some other issues, including Garnett not really being exciting to come to the franchise. But I had no idea that they were.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that.
Yeah, for him.
That would have been weird. I don't know about Kevin Garnett and a Don Nelson.
I don't know
if I like that.
I kind of think that might have. I mean, he wouldn't have shot threes, but I kind of think that would have worked. I mean, he can space the floor. And I mean, obviously, you know, just he'll be tremendous defensively and change the culture that way. You know, I don't know. Maybe the system wouldn't work. Maybe the attitudes wouldn't work. But I could see it just kind of from a basketball perspective. I think I just think Garnett's so flexible and so
right
in a weird way, even though he's just very like conservative in his temperament. But I just think he's just such a, I guess, a basketball genius, for lack of a better term. I could just see him kind of fitting basically in almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe you might be right, but
it'd be goofy. It'd be goofy anyway. But I do want to see it. I have a definite curiosity to see it. One of my favorite things ever is to think of, like, especially when you talk about Don Nelson or like run and gun, and just see how like certain guys would work in those systems and in that. Because like he was a mad scientist too. Like he would have probably found a way to maximize what Kevin Garnett did, and then in 2 years Kevin Garnett would have hated him, and then he'd be like, that's the Don Nelson thing. Is like, he comes in, like, everyone's like, ah, and then, like, he makes the most out of you, and then you, like, hate him, like, a year later, and then he's all gone, and he calls you an asshole. You know, like, it's just the Don Nelson thing that happens, and I'm sure that would have been, like, really fun for, like, 6 months, and then they would have hated each other, and then something would have happened afterwards, but that's all right.
Right.
We can dream, but still, Kevin Garnett in a Warriors uniform, that's got to be pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
Any trade that doesn't happen is pretty awesome, let's be honest.
It is. Although they had a terrible uniform then, so that was only.
Oh, with the stupid blue man holding a lightning bolt for some reason.
Yeah.
Like,
so
what is that? Yeah. Nothing to do with San Francisco. And then like you go to the arena and you go and like you just see like how cool it is and how the atmosphere of it or whatever, and you're like, man, they wasted so many years and terrible jerseys.
Yeah.
Just god awful jerseys.
Luckily, their
current scheme is awesome.
They're
current
pretty great now. Yeah, works. But So, I don't know. Anything else, Rich?
Not really. No. trying to do updates on the current trade deadline. Nothing coming up right now, but any thoughts on what's going on right now and any predictions of guys that move or anything like that?
I don't know, man. I mean, it's been a weird day because, of course, basically they've announced that Goran Dragic wants out of Phoenix. I mean, they've said it privately. They've all but said it publicly. I guess Ty Lawson didn't show up for practice. So there's
Reggie Jackson also.
Yeah, privately, and he's basically all but said it publicly too. They can't say it publicly unless they want to get fined. So it just there's a lot of pieces out there. It's sort of hard to see how they fit together, but you never know. I mean, the Nets are sort of out there. There's been talk of Joe Johnson to the Pistons, and anything that makes the Nets worse, giving up talent, it makes me happy, because if the Nets miss the playoff, well, no matter what, the Hawks get the Nets pick, but obviously the Nets, they have the right to swap picks. So the Nets not making the playoffs gives them a small chance to, get further into the lottery. And, obviously the better the pick the better it benefits the Hawks. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's,
imagine having,
I feel like this is going to be a very interesting trade deadline for one big reason. And it's really, we really haven't had this in a lot of years where it's a pretty open field. Like, to be honest, in a lot of years, there are a few teams here and there, but people sort of say, it's Miami, when LeBron was there, it's Oklahoma City or maybe the people weren't really picking the Spurs. They kind of came out of nowhere. But for the most part, everybody kind of knew, okay, Miami out of the East and maybe somebody will beat them or whatever. But for the chances are, it's probably gonna be them. And then Oklahoma City, they're awesome. Maybe somebody will beat them or whatever. And, obviously it happened here and there, but this year you really, honestly, more than any other year that I can remember in recent history, like I really don't know. Like, there's so many teams that could make the NBA final. Like, matchups in the NBA finals, like you can come up with 6 or 7 or 8 matchups or whatever, and be totally justified. Like, nobody would argue with you.
Yeah,
like in previous years, you can't like be like, yeah, Bulls Grizzlies, and it's like, yeah, that's probably not gonna happen. You know what I mean? Like last year, like people are gonna look at you like you're an idiot. Like, maybe, okay, whatever, but like, it's probably not gonna happen. But this year, if you said a Hawks Warriors, perfectly logical.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Trailblazers Bulls, perfectly logical. Like, you know what I mean? Sure. Like, there's a lot of really weird ones that like at the end of the day, Oklahoma City might not make it at all. San Antonio doesn't look very good, but you can still say, if you said Cleveland San Antonio, I'd say, okay, probably. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's really weird this year.
I mean, any of the 8 teams out west, and I think between 3 and 5 teams in east, any of those teams I think could make the finals. Yeah, so
absolutely. And you don't get that many years in the NBA.
No, definitely not. That's, yeah, I mean,
and historically, the west, I mean, historically
crazy.
You don't really get
yeah that. I mean, the west, yeah. Yeah, especially the weird thing, of course, is if Oklahoma City puts it together in the 8th seed, I mean, that's a that's a dangerous season series.
Well, you're talking about Indiana.
How historic
Indiana too. They're true. Possibly Paul George coming back. Yeah. I mean, they could be
and Miami, honestly, yeah, Miami too. I mean, Miami. If Bosch and if they make a trade and they have healthy Bosch and Wade and Whiteside, being great. I mean, that's they're. That's an interesting series for whoever.
I mean, how many years can you look at the 8th seed and be like, oh, look at the 8th? I mean, if they make the playoffs, they're gonna make a hell of a run. Like, that's just unprecedented.
Yeah.
Year, and I don't know if injuries have caused a lot of it, but which kind of sucks. But there's also just been a lot of parity this year. I think the talent dispersal is very interesting right now in the
NBA.
Yeah,
it's weird, and I obviously hope that. Apparently Joan Kersey died today. Mark Spears is reporting it. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh. Well, maybe that's a topic we'll have to look into later. But wow,
man, how old was he? 52. Yeah. Oh man, I was gonna say he couldn't be that old.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
That sucks. Anthony Mason's not doing well either. This is no good.
Yeah,
no good.
I know, it's rough, man. It's rough. Well, anyway, Rich.
and on that note.
So anyway, everyone of course can check us out at thepodiumgame.com. Our podcasts are posted there. We'd love it. Any feedback you want to give us, you can leave a comment there in the post, or you could post on our Twitter or Facebook pages, twitter.com/overandbacknba, or same for Facebook. We also blog a little bit at overandbacknba.com, and we'd really love it if you would give our show or the Hardwood Paroxysm network of shows, which on iTunes, if you would leave us a rating or review, we'd appreciate that. You can just search for, you can search for Over and Back NBA. You can find the Hardwood Paroxysm feed, or you can search for Hardwood Paroxysm Network. Either way, you will find our show. And we, of course, have many other great shows, Biscast Ball, Rise and Scribe, the Podium Game Podcast, R Squared, and got a few others on there as well. It's a big network and a lot of great shows on there. We encourage you to check out our other Podium Game shows. I think there's a great mix of different types of things on there. So, Rich, thanks for doing another one of these with me.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one. So we'll have to come back again sometime soon, and it might be sooner rather than later. I'd like to let's tentatively target doing a Jerome Kersey one. I'd like to do that. That's a fun, interesting one that nobody else is really gonna, you know what I mean? Like a podcast about Jerome Kersey. Like, who else can do that besides us?
Oh, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Like right there. Let's.
All right,
we can settle that.
We will settle that. All right. So. So thanks, everyone, for checking us out, and we'll be back again soon.